Our Bibles and turn to the Old Testament book of Ezra. It's probably been a while since you've read Ezra. If you're thinking, refresh my memory on where Ezra is, go to Psalms and go back four books, and you'll be there. Ezra chapter 8, Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, Job, Psalms, Proverbs. That's what we learned as kids, right? We talk a lot in our studies about the fact that as Christians, we walk by faith and not by sight. And in some ways, that's a really nice theological concept until we have to live it out personally. And when the answers aren't clear and God's leading seems still murky, like that wise study we did last week, I was just talking to somebody. That's why I was out there talking to somebody about this very thing a couple minutes ago. When the answers aren't clear and the leading's not clear and it's kind of a question of why and what and when and where and how and all that kind of stuff, how willing are we still to trust the Lord without any hesitation? How willing are we to just to go forward and just keep persevering and keep being steadfast in our faith? And going along with that, is our faith strong enough at that point to not require tangible evidence from God? I remember when I was in high school and then in college, I would often, in praying for the Lord's leading, I'd often say, Lord, if you could just give me a sign, some proof that I can really, trust you even more effectively or to verify that you're actually hearing me. I know you're hearing me, but boy, if you could just give me a sign, that would be great. How many have done that before? You pray, Lord, just give me a sign. That's harmless enough, right? We just like a little assist to our faith. Just a little extra, let me have a little bit more evidence, because 1 Corinthians 13 says we see through a glass darkly, and God knows how to turn the opaque into the clear. So Lord, just give me a little bit of a sign. We also have to be careful of that doesn't kind of become our default way of thinking, that we'll trust when God gives us evidence. Because Jesus warned us in Mark chapter 8 that a wicked generation seeks a sign. And he was talking there to the Pharisees about their hypocrisy, and they were trying to trap him and say, do miracles on command, kind of do what we want to prove yourself. And he knew they'd never believe him. He knew that they were just really testing him and trying to confuse the people and cut into his credibility. So Jesus said, I'm not going to do that. But he also warns us for a couple reasons, and that is that we have all the evidence we're ever going to need right now that he's worthy of our faith. We don't really need more. He's given us abundant evidence. If we're lacking, we're going, well, what is that? You're holding it in your hand right here. This is all the evidence we need right here, that God's worthy of our trust. But then we've got times he's answered prayer, and we've got experiences, and we've got clear leading that he's shown us. So he says, be careful that you're not always asking for more proof, because I've given you enough proof. And then we also have to guard, as we talked a couple weeks ago, about only believing when we're comfortable with it. And that can be very subtle and really quickly cause us to put kind of a passive resistance to faith. Kind of saying, well, I'll do it when it's clear to me. I'll do it when it's acceptable to me. But that's not really the way it works, is it? We're not going to just joyfully sign on to something that's really challenging and really stretching our faith and that's not clear, especially in the short term, because we can't see what the Lord's doing. God sees everything at a moment, so we can't see what he's got planned on the line or why he's doing it or why we're going through this trial right now and what the purpose might be and how we're going to grow out of that. So we don't seek out the tough assignments. We seek out the ones that are easier. And that's why this passage is important. It's kind of an obscure passage in Ezra chapter 8, but I think it really shows an essential truth about faith that every one of us needs to learn more fully. Whether you've been saved 5 days or 50 years, there is something about faith that is important that we need to see kind of at the outset this morning. And that is that the deepest level of faith is when we can't see, but we still believe. Because that's how Hebrews 11 defines it. Faith is easy when you know what's going to happen. Faith is easy when all the plot is laid out. You can say, well, I see that path. That's okay, Lord, I can trust you for that. But when you can't see, Jesus says, and you still believe, that's when faith really takes hold. That's where faith is at its deepest. And if you're here this morning and you've never trusted Jesus as your Savior and you never put your faith in him, this study's for you too, because saving faith requires us to place our lives and our confidence in a truth that we cannot visibly or tangibly verify. I have never seen Jesus Christ face to face. I've been to Israel. I've seen where he's crucified and where they say he was laid, but I've never seen Jesus Christ. I'm trusting what the Word says. I'm trusting what the Holy Spirit has impressed upon my heart. I'm trusting what I believe after logical, rational study is true compared to everything else. But I can't tangibly verify it. So even if you're not saved this morning and you're sitting there going, I don't know if I can trust this, you're going to have to at some point trust by faith that that's true. And whether you've been saved 50 years and you're going to a deeper level, or whether you're the person I just described, the end result of this level of faith is very, very exciting. And we tend to think, because that's the enemy's pushing against us, that it's not exciting, that it's scary, that it's dangerous, that we'd prefer it a different way. But this is really the purest essence of trust. And when we trust this way, as we're going to see in a couple minutes, the Lord responds in very powerful, awesome ways. So look at Ezra chapter 8. We're going to read verse 21 in just a minute. But let me give you a little bit of context for what's going on. This is the second group of Jews that was out of Judah. The ten tribes of the north, Israel, was carried away to Assyria. The two tribes of the south, Judah, were carried away to Babylon. This is the group that went to Babylon. And there's one group that had already gone back out of captivity back to Jerusalem. They went 60 years earlier. They were led by a man named Zerubbabel. And now 60 years later, a group led by this prophet Ezra now starts the journey back to Jerusalem. The temple's been rebuilt, but things are not going very well. There's now apathy, and there's kind of the work has stopped, and the wall's not fully rebuilt, and the people have just kind of lost hope and lost confidence. So Ezra is going to be instrumental. He takes a group of about 4,000 or 5,000 people, and they go back and kind of build a revival, and the people start to trust the Lord again and start to obey the Lord. And by the end of the book, you see that Israel's renewed its covenant with the Lord, and the people are obeying, and everything is back to where it should be. Now, chapter 8, where we are this morning, is really a pivotal point in that taking place, because the people, the second wave, is about to make a 1,700-mile trip through the desert back to Jerusalem. And I've got a couple maps I want to show you this morning. You see the red line here, that's the second group that's going back. So they're starting in Babylon, which is where to the right of the screen that begins, and they're going to go back over and then down into the north side, what is now Lebanon, down past the Sea of Galilee and back to Jerusalem. Now, if you look at the second map, keep that in mind, Mediterranean's to the left. You can see how this relates to our modern-day geography. So essentially, they're starting over near Baghdad. They're going up through Syria, down through Lebanon, past Damascus, down through Haifa, what's now the West Bank, and into Jerusalem. So you can get some perspective on what's happening here, where they are, and where they're going. So this is a long journey. It's 1,700 miles. It's dangerous. There are all kinds of people that are waiting to attack. And this is not an army. This is not David and his troops marching from Babylon to Jerusalem. This is a group of people that has lived their whole lives in captivity. It's men, it's women, it's children. And they're going to have to show a level of dependence now on the Lord that they haven't really shown as a nation for hundreds of years. Let's read how they show this and what the Lord does to bless their faith. Start in verse 21. Then I proclaimed a fast there at the river Ahava, that we might humble ourselves before the Lord our God to seek from him a safe journey for us. our little ones, and our possessions. For I was ashamed to request from the king troops and horsemen to protect us from the enemy on the way, because we had said to the king, the hand of our God is favorably disposed to all who seek him, but his power and his anger are against all those who forsake him. So we fasted and sought the Lord our God concerning this matter, and he listened to our entreaty. Then I set apart 12 of the leading priests, Sherebiah, Hashabiah, with them 10 of their brothers, and I weighed out to them the silver, the gold, the utensils, the offering for the house of our God, which the king and his counselors and princes and all Israel present had there had offered. Thus I weighed into their hands 650 talents of silver, and silver utensils worth 100 talents, 100 gold talents, 20 gold bowls worth 100 barracks, 2 utensils of fine, shiny bronze, precious as gold. Then I said to them, you're holy to the Lord. The utensils are holy, and the silver and gold are a freewill offering to the Lord of your fathers. Watch them and keep them until you weigh them before the leading priests, the Levites, and the heads of the fathers' households of Israel at Jerusalem in the changers of the house of the Lord. In other words, we're going to take this offering back, and I want you to safeguard it until we get to Jerusalem and can weigh it in the temple. So the priests and the Levites accepted the weighed out silver and gold and the utensils to bring them to Jerusalem to the house of our God. Then we journeyed from the river Ahava on the 12th of the first month to go to Jerusalem, and the hand of our God was over us, and he delivered us from the hand of the enemies and the ambushes by the way. Thus we came to Jerusalem and remained there for 3 days. Now, the first rest stop as they go up along the Euphrates is about 75 miles north of Babylon. It's at this river, and here they kind of catch their breath, and they camp out for 3 days to make sure they're prepared for the trip ahead. Now, Ezra's purpose in doing this is far more spiritual than physical. This is a big journey. There's 5,000 people. There's men, women, and children. They're traveling through harsh deserts. So 75 miles of walking, that's pretty significant. But Ezra is not doing this because they need a pit stop. He wants to make sure that they are ready spiritually, that they're ready to follow the Lord, and that the Lord is with them and leading them. So if you look back at verse 15, it says that he looks for some Levites because they're the tribe of priests. And he says, I want to make sure that we're being led by the ones who are listening to the Lord and who are serving the Lord. So he looks around and he can't find any. There aren't any Levites to be found. So rather than going forward, he sends a group of men to a man named Iddo at a nearby town called Casiphia. You say, why do I care about this? Well, it matters to the story. Because in Casiphia, there apparently was a group of Levite Jews living there. And his request, look at verse 17, he says, bring us ministers for the house of God. Now, this is very interesting because they have no temple, they have no tabernacle, they have no tent of meeting. They don't even have a cloud leading them like their forefathers had as they went to the promised land. They have absolutely nothing. It's just this unspectacular group of a couple thousand people that's wandering through the desert, that have been in captivity for 70 years. All they want to do is go back to Jerusalem. But they knew that they needed the hand of the Lord on them. They knew that they could not do this by themselves. So they said, we need some of the ministers, we need some of the Levites and the priests to be with them and lead them and strengthen us for the trip. Now, if you look at it from just a purely logical standpoint, a purely logistical standpoint, some would say, well, that's great. That's good you've got the Levites and the priests and you want the Lord to be in that. But really, that's second on the order of importance, because the first thing you're going to need to make this kind of trip through the desert where people want to rob you and kill you is you're going to need some military protection. And the king of Babylon apparently had been willing to give them that. He had been willing to give them some troops to make sure they got there safely. But this is where the first measure of faith comes in. It's really where the heart of our study is this morning. Because Ezra says to himself, if we ask for that extra help, it's going to contradict what we told the king. it's going to show that we don't really have confidence in the Lord's help. Now, before we develop that, because that's going to be most of what we're going to study, look back at verse 21 just for a second. Because as they're seeking wisdom, as they're trying to figure out what to do, Ezra calls the people to a three-day fast. They've just been walking. They've been through the desert. They're hot. They're steamy. They're tired. The kids are complaining. I mean, it's kind of a miserable trip. And they get to this place, this river, and they're like, oh, okay, now we can relax a little bit. We'll get a little bit of water. We'll get refreshed. Ezra says, nope, we're not going to eat for 3 days. And they're like, bad idea, Ezra. We're hungry. We're thirsty. We really want to take care of ourselves. But he says, nope. Here's what we've got to do. Look at verse 21. We have got to humble ourselves before the Lord and seek his help. Now, I want you to notice that these two things are inseparable. And this is an overall principle that applies to any aspect of prayer, whether we're asking for forgiveness and salvation or asking for healing and restoration or looking for guidance, protection, whatever the case may be. We can't ask the Lord to help. We can't expect him to honor that request for help if we aren't willing to first humble ourselves and admit how much we need him. It's worthless. It's a waste of time for us to go and say to the Lord, Lord, I need your help, but it's on my terms. Lord, I need your help, but I need it on this timetable. Lord, I need your help, but it has to be a certain way. No, we have to go to him and say, I'm all yours. I'm surrendered to you. Everything that you're going to do, it's in your hands. I'm not going to fight. I'm not going to argue. I'm just going to trust you. And when we do that, because that's what they're doing here, that's when God starts to work. Now you say, well, that seems extreme. Why do we have to do that? Because humbling strips away self. And when our self is stripped away, we regain perspective and insight that we need. Now, that's not just about prayer. We need this as a constant daily exercise because self is so strong and so invasive and so insidious, and it never stops demanding its way. Self never stops saying that it needs answers. Self never stops being offended and outraged that it's not in control. And if you think that's hyperbole or an overstatement, it's actually not. It's actually short-selling how nasty self is. And we don't want to admit it because we're nice people and we're happy. Everybody's nice this morning, right? We're all nice people. We're dressing them. We're having a good day. Why are you telling me I'm nasty? I'm not telling you you're nasty. I'm telling you our pride is nasty. Our self is nasty because it's hostile toward what God wants to do. And until we see that rebellious attitude of our pride, that it's determined to separate us from the Lord, it's determined to destroy us, and until we reject its demands and say, you are not in control, the Lord is in control, until we do that, we will be outside of the will of God. Now, Ezra knows this. He knows this about his people. He knows their history. He knows the whole reason that they were in Babylon in the first place was that the nation for years and years and years and years and years had rejected the Lord. They had refused to follow. They had refused to trust. They had refused to obey until the Lord finally said, enough already. You're going to have to go into a difficult situation so you will learn. So I believe this fast is much more about the short, much more about the long term than about the short term. But Ezra says, look, there's no sense for us praying for help. We can have the Levites. We can have an army. It really doesn't matter. If the Lord isn't with us, we have no hope. If the Lord's not in the center of what you're doing this morning, nothing else matters. Nothing is going to succeed. Nothing will help you. And ultimately, and I don't mean to be a pessimist here, ultimately, if the Lord's not in the center of what we're doing, everything will fail and fall away. Everything. And in addition, he may take his hand off of us and stop showing us favor until we get our heart right. Or worse, he may put his hand on us and say, you're going to go through a trial because your pride is killing you. And I need to humble you for your sake. Now, that's not the Lord being harsh or unfair. That's what the devil wants us to think. anytime we go through difficulty, like we said last week, why, Lord? Why are you doing this? Why are you allowing this? Why is the Lord being unfair to me? I've been praying and I've been walking with the Lord and it seems like life's just getting tougher. I've had people say that to me all through the years in counseling. The closer I get to the Lord, the harder it gets. Yeah, because the devil hates that. Of course he's going to fight that. But don't believe the lie that the Lord is being harsh or unfair when he disciplines us. Whom the Lord loves, he chastens. It's because of his love, knowing that we will never be more fulfilled. We will never be more content. We will never be more at peace. This is not what the devil wants us to believe, but this is the truth. We'll never be that way than when we're humble and we're being led by the Lord. You will never be more satisfied, more refreshed, more at peace, more just content and full of joy than when self is less and he is more and he's leading you and guiding you, even when you can't see it, even when it's not clear, but you're right in the center of the will. And Ezra understood this. He had learned this from watching the past, and he knew that living for the Lord in the present was the only way they were going to get there, and he knew that the future was all in the Lord's hand. This is the only path to success. So Ezra says, I know you're tired and I know you're hot, and I know you're weary, and I know you're hungry, but we need to fast. The challenge for us in 2019 is that goes against everything we hear. We're told that you are nobody, that nobody will notice you without self-promotion. We're told that to live for yourself and to ask God for whatever you want because he just wants you to be happy. We're told that the Bible has way more latitude than we would let on because God has just flexibility and his word kind of means what it means, but it doesn't really mean what it means. You don't have to really take it literally. Just let it be subjective and kind of figure out how you feel about it that day. Let me just remind you just for a second. We'll put the verses on the screen. Let me remind you what James chapter 4 says. The source of conflict is seeking pleasure that wages war inside you. James 4:3 says, you don't have because you don't ask, and you ask and don't receive because you're asking with the wrong motives to spend it on your own pleasure. Sorry, the words are a little off there. Verse 4 says, whoever seeks to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. Verse 6 says, God's opposed to the proud but gives grace to the humble. Verse 7 says, resist the devil and he'll flee from you. Draw near to God and he'll draw near to you. Verse 8 says, cleanse your hands and purify your hearts. Verse 10 says, humble yourself in the sight of the Lord and he will lift you up. Now, all of those verses from just one chapter, James chapter 4, contradicts the devil's narrative. The devil's narrative is live for yourself, do your thing. You don't have to trust the Lord. That's too hard. Obeying the word's too hard. Following God's too hard. You just need to settle into what's comfortable. But God says, here's the equation for blessing. Humble yourself before me. Separate yourself from sin. Ask with the right motives that I will be glorified and that you'll be under my hands. Cleanse your hands. Purify your heart. Resist the devil. And I will bless you beyond measure. That's the equation. Now, we can believe James chapter 4, and we can say, well, that's the only way to go, or we can reject it and fall back into our own patterns. Ezra knows what Israel was inclined to do. So look back at the text. He says, we need to get right with the Lord. We need to trust the Lord completely. Because our faith is going to be put to the test on this long trip. And our lives and our possessions are almost certainly going to be attacked. There were whole groups of Bedouin Arabs that were roaming around that area, 1,700 miles. They're moving back and forth, and they're finding weak parties and people that have wives and children and people that are not healthy. They're just looking for that. They're not going to attack armies. They're going to attack people that are vulnerable. So as they're going on this journey, Ezra knows this is going to be an issue. It would have been less an issue if they had had an army from Babylon, but they don't. They're on their own. And here's where the rub comes in. Look back at verses 21 and 22, please. They could have asked the king of Babylon for military support. The king certainly knew the dangers. But Ezra thought to himself, and he reasoned, I have a significant problem if I do that. Because he had spoken so confidently about the Lord's faithful and sufficient protection that he says, if I go to the king and ask for help, the king might doubt the power of God and he might question our faith. You get where this is going? So if I go into the king and I say, well, Lord, king, we've talked to you for years about how faithful God is, how powerful God is, how he protects those that live for him. You see in verse 22, he said, I had boldly told the king, the hand of our God is favorably disposed on those who trust him, but his power and anger are against those who reject him. So he's told the king many times, God works, God's favorable, God helps those who love him. Now he's going to go into the king and he's going to say, yes, that's true, but we'd really like some extra help. And Ezra says to himself, how is the king going to interpret that? King's not a believer. And he's heard about the absolute confidence they have in the Lord's power and authority and that his people trust him and that God's people have his power engaged for them and his power is engaged against those who reject him. What's the king going to think? This is a very important truth for us today, and you're going to see it on the screen, that the Lord promises to keep those who love and seek him. He promises to keep us safe and protected in any danger. He also promises, based on verse 22, that he will expose anyone who doesn't. Now, that's a very important line of delineation for us this morning. Where do we fall on that list? Love him, trust him, serve him, obey him. He says, if you do that, I'll protect you. I'll keep you safe. You'll be under the shadow of my wings. I'll be your shield and buckler. I will take care of you. I will never take my eyes off of you. But if you oppose me, if you fail to trust me, if you reject me, I'm going to expose you. Now, Ezra not only fully believed that, but look at verse 22. He had declared it to the king. So he says to himself, to now come back and ask for tangible help feels like a real compromise. I mean, the king might question, well, I thought you've been telling me all these years that your God was so powerful and so merciful and that he helps those who trust in him. Ezra, do you trust in him? Oh, yes, king, I trust in him. Well, then why do you need extra help? Well, it's just kind of logical, right? Because we're going through the desert. We need some armies. Well, I thought God will protect you. Well, yes, that's true. But we just need to be sure. We just need to make sure. I think Ezra really believes at that point the king may mock him. And this leads us into our second spiritual principle this morning. For our faith to be proven and for the Lord's hand to be obvious, we can't require a safety net. It's kind of a weird sentence, and I struggled on how to write that, but let's just go with it. For our faith to be proven, for the Lord's hand to be obvious, we can't require a safety net. A couple months ago, we studied about faith, and we said if we're going to live by faith, we have to commit all the way. Not when it's convenient, not when it's circumstantial, not when our emotions are high and we just can't do it. Faith can't come with any conditions. It can't come with conditions that are acceptable to us. Or when I can see it more clearly, then I'm going to trust. There will be many times that you and I've faced this many times in my life. There are many times when we'll go forward equipped only with his presence and his word and his promise. And here's what's so exciting about that. Those are the times where you really see the hand of the Lord. Those are the times when you go, oh, Lord, I didn't have any evidence, and I was just going by faith. And look at how you worked. Oh, praise your name. That's what I see. That's how you show how faithful you are. And you know what happens? When you go through those times, your faith and your confidence and your contentment goes through the roof. Anybody can trust when it's easy. Anybody can trust when it's obvious. But the Lord wants us to trust even when we can't see. And this is an issue of testing God. It's not saying, well, Lord, I'm going to put myself in rough situations to see if you really act. Like the devil says to Jesus, jump off the pinnacle of the temple. Because Psalm 22 says the angels will catch you. God doesn't play those games. Don't put yourself in rough situations on purpose to say, well, Lord, you got to show up now. Instead, this is just learning to live with a supernatural dependence that sees the invisible hand of God. Remember, we studied a couple years ago about Elisha at Dothan? Remember that passage? And he's trapped and he's in the city and the armies surround him and his servants with him. It's like, this is curtains, like the whole city's surrounded and we're right in the middle. And Elijah's servant is panicking and freaking out. And what are we going to do? And we're going to die. And this is horrible. And Elisha prays to the Lord. And he says, Lord, open his eyes. And the servant looks up. And all on the mountain surrounding the armies that are surrounding them are chariots of fire. That's the invisible hand of God. So you say, well, Paul, that's a great theory. That's nice, and I want to believe that way. So how can I be confident? How can I be sure that if I do that, that God will come through? Look at the screen for a second. Because Hebrews 10:23 says, he is faithful who promised. Psalm 73:23 says, we don't need to fear because he will help us. Psalm 5:12 says, he blesses the righteous and surrounds us with his favor like a shield. And Isaiah 41:10 says, he holds us with his righteous right hand. See, the hand of God is awesome and it's powerful and it marks our lives. And when you look back at verse 22, he says, I'm favorably disposed to all who trust in me. That's God's promise. That's not, well, if you trust me, I might come through for you. We'll kind of see how it goes. Let's see how strong your faith is, and let's see if the situation merits my help. I'm going to kind of evaluate. I'll assess. We'll put together a team that'll figure out if Paul Rhodes' need is enough right now, and I might come alongside you. We'll just take it as it goes. No, that's not what he says. That's nowhere in verse 22. He says, you love me, you trust me, I'm there. I am favorable to you. I will bless you. I will help you. I will be there with you. I'm faithful because I promise and my word is perfect. And you don't need to fear because I'm going to help you. And I will surround you and I'll guard you and I'll shield you and uphold you with my righteous right hand. You will not need to worry because I will be there. And Ezra and the people here, oh, it's so beautiful. They go forward into uncertainty. They go forward into difficult circumstances, knowing that God will not abandon them, because how would he allow his people to be exposed? Listen, this is so contradictory to our culture right now. It's so hard for us to rely on something we can't see. We're such a visual society. And we want to take, we want evidence of every experience, right? So people go out to eat and they get a plate of food. What do? Pull out the phone, take a picture, post it on Instagram. Look, I ate a meal today. Good for you. I got a latte frappuccino with mocha. And look, they did a little swirl of a heart in my coffee. I need a picture of that. And there are places we go. I want to show you that I was here. I don't know if you saw the story this week about this tourist attraction in Bali. Could you put the picture of this? Beautiful place. It's called, I think, Heaven's Gate or something. I can't remember the name of it. Forgive me. And all these influencers on Instagram are getting their picture in Bali. It's like a two-hour trip through the mountains to get there. And the story this week was, people that are going there and making this long trip through the mountains of Bali to get to this place, get there, and they're completely disillusioned. You know why? Because there's no water there. It's a concrete path. You know how they get this picture? the little guy with the camera who's sitting there taking your money holds up a mirror underneath the camera lens and takes the picture so it looks like there's this big lake right in front of this beautiful setting. And now people are showing up and they're like, wait a minute. We just came 2 hours in a bus through the mountains. There's no water there. We want to see it. We went out to the observatory the other night out in Union Grove, and we looked through the telescopes that were out there, saw the mountains on the moon and the craters, saw the landing site of Apollo 11. And then we went to a couple and we saw Jupiter, three of its moons. You could see the lines on Jupiter. And the one I really love is Saturn. You look through a telescope and you see Saturn and the rings, and they're pronounced. You could see some of the definition between the rings. And literally, the family said, we're getting emotional about this. Here's the hand of God that's placed out there, and that's just a minor, tiny little speck. It would be like literally a grain of sand in this room. I don't even think that would be right. That's probably not a big enough room of how vast the universe is. But we want to see everything. We want it to be in our hands. We want to know, well, God, what's coming next? And when is it going to happen? If I could just see it, Lord, then I trust you. God says, that's not how faith works. Faith is seeing what's hidden. Now, granted, it would seem much easier to have tangible armies walking with them. But Ezra says, look, if we're really going to trust the Lord and we're not going to compromise our witness, we at this point, people, we're going to have to trust in what's unseen. And we're going to fast, and we're going to pray, and we're going to humble ourselves before the Lord, and then we're going to ask him for his help. And for 1,700 miles, we are going to trust that not one person is going to touch a single one of us, because God says, I will help you. Think of the level of faith of that. And here's something I really want us to get. The Lord is looking for faith that is so strong and so confident in him that no matter what the situation is, trusting doesn't feel like a risk. Oh, that truth hit me this week. That I would get to a place in my faith where I never say to myself, oh, it's kind of risky at this point. This, I'm really living on the edge now. If I'm going to trust the Lord for this, ooh, I don't know. That's right out there on the very edges of what's comfortable. I want to get to a place where my faith is so strong and so confident that whatever happens, that I say, praise the Lord, because that's what it's supposed to be. Faith like Jairus, who says, you don't need to come, just say the word. The centurion who says, you don't need to come to my house, just say the word. The woman with the hemorrhage, you just touch. If I can just touch him, then I'll be healed. And God says, I want to see that faith every day. Now, if we can finish with one thing, I think it's really important, and we're still a little early here. This whole idea is borne out in the second half of the text. Let's just take 2 or 3 minutes on it, because in verses 24 to 32, Ezra sets apart these 12 Levites. You can see them, their names, starting in verse 24. I think I pronounced them right, but if I didn't, just forgive me. These 12 Levites are going to guard the offering that they're bringing to the temple. And he says, we're going to publicly weigh the metals. Now, why'd they do that? They did that for integrity, because the human heart can be very deceitful, and they want to be open about accountability and responsibility. So they say, this offering is holy to the Lord. We want to make sure that as many grams of precious metal that we have right now here at this river are going to, when we get 1,700 miles later and we get to the temple and we present them all to the priests that are working full-time in the temple, that at every single ounce of metal is accounted for. So when we read the details in verse 26, we say, why are they giving all the details about how much it is and what's a talent and what's a, I don't know, why is that there? Listen, that's there because the Lord wants us to know how much they were carrying. When they add up all the gold and all the silver and all the copper, which at that point was as precious as gold, it came to about 1.2 million in today's dollars. So they're going to walk through a barren desert where there are robbers at every turn without an army, just men, women, and children. They're going to walk 1,700 miles carrying $1 million on them. Think anybody would want to mess with them at all? They're carrying all this precious metal. And it hit me as I read that and studied that, that really there is a literal price tag on their faith at this point. They're carrying $1 million. They have no defense other than they fully believe the Lord will protect them. They believe God will honor this offering. They know that their hearts are committed to Him. Their faith is strong and unwavering. How would the Lord not defend that? And I believe in that moment, you see it where it says the offering was holy to the Lord. I believe not only was the offering holy to the Lord, but the people themselves became holy to the Lord. They were the offering. The offering, listen, God doesn't need our gold and silver, right? He owns everything. Do you know there's an asteroid right now that has so much precious metal on it that if they could harvest it, did I tell you this story last week? Every person in the world would be an instant billionaire. It would crash the world's economy if they could get just a little bit off this one asteroid that's full of precious metal. God doesn't need our gold. God doesn't need our silver. He's not going, well, I better get all 1.2 million. I need that in my car. No, listen, God owns everything. The people themselves become holy to the Lord. They are the offering. Their faith is the offering. And I want to ask you this morning, what would happen if your faith was like that? What would happen if my faith was like that? Think of all the things that we need to trust the Lord. I mean, really trust the Lord for. Your marriage, if it's struggling. Your kids, if they're wandering away. Or even if they're not, they're going to be tempted to at some point. Your job, your finances, whatever the case may be. Just tomorrow, your health, waking up. Are we really, really, really going to trust the Lord for that? Is all that His? Or are we saying, well, I'm kind of managing it for the Lord. I'll take care of it. And when a crisis hits, then I'm going to ask the Lord. I'm going to ask the church to pray for me because I've got a crisis now. And as soon as the crisis passes, I'm back to managing my own stuff. What if we trusted the Lord this way as a church? In our prayer, for our finances, for the renovations of the building, for our outreach efforts, for reaching people for Christ. Like, what if we really trusted the Lord this way? And what if we asked Him to expand our influence for the name of Jesus Christ? And we put our full faith into it and said, we're completely yours, Lord. You show us what to do and we'll do it. See, faith never sees the obstacles. It only sees the Lord's provision. And when the Lord is providing, listen, this is important. When the Lord is providing, there is zero risk. The risk comes when we try to grab onto it. Now, how would the Lord respond to this kind of faith? Let's read verse 31 and finish. How will the Lord, if the Lord sees us doing that in our lives and in our families and in our church, if the Lord looks at our faith and goes, oh, look at that, look at that, look at that. Look at that faith. Remember, there are people in the New Testament that Jesus marveled at over their faith. So if God sees that kind of faith, how will He respond? Look at verse 31. It says, then we journeyed from the river to go to Jerusalem, and the hand of our God was over us, and He delivered us from the hand of our enemy and the ambushes by the way. Then we got to Jerusalem. This is how God works when we trust Him. The hand of the Lord was over us, and He delivered us. The situation, we entered into it, man, it was daunting. It was scary. We didn't know what was going to happen. We didn't have any army. Ezra wouldn't go ask the king for help. So now we're out here in the desert by ourselves, and we're just exposed, and we've got $1 million on us. And it's not traveler's checks. Like, they can't be replaced. This is going to get stolen from us. Our defenses are non-existent. But we humbled ourselves. We submitted to the sufficiency of God. And the Lord's hand was with us. and our enemies never had a chance. And we traveled in perfect safety, and we arrived securely in Jerusalem. And when we weighed out the gold and the silver and the copper, there was $1.2 million. Because God protected us. Listen, if he can do that with something so valuable, how many know that he certainly can help us this week? He is a gracious God. He will be generous. He will be so generous with his presence and his protection and his power and his peace. It'll all be there. He'll help us. And that's not just pie in the sky. We're thinking the best thoughts and we're hoping. No, this is the word of God. This is the promise of God. And he says, if you just will submit it to me, and you won't demand a safety net, you won't always demand answers, because I'm not always going to give them to you. If you will just trust me, I will provide. So the question for us this morning is, what do you need to trust him for? What do you need to put in his hands this morning?